Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of You Don't Need Heroin to Be a Hero. For those of you who are new to the podcast, we are a nonprofit anti-drug abuse group of individuals who seek to spread awareness on the dangers of drug abuse and discuss how it's affecting our community, our nation, and our world. Today, my good friend Alex Hess and I are going to be covering the deadly opioid epidemic.
Thanks for having me on the podcast today, Jake.
Now, before we dive right into the opioid epidemic, why don't we first start with a brief description of what opioids are and how they affect our body?
Well, according to the National Institute for Drug Abuse in 2018, opioids are a class of drugs that include the illegal drug heroin, synthetic opioids such as fentanyl, and pain relievers available legally by prescription such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, codeine, morphine, and many others. Opioids are commonly prescribed to treat pain as they bind to receptors in the brain and spinal cord that block pain. This pain blockage can also result in a feeling of euphoria or high. It is easy to become addicted to this high feeling, leading to drug misuse. During an overdose, these drugs overwhelm receptors in the brain, reduce the body's drive to breathe, and eliminate the alarm response that would normally occur in an oxygen-starved state. Breathing can also slow to a dangerous level or stop completely. Reversing these effects as quickly as possible is needed to prevent brain damage and death.
As of October 2017, the opioid epidemic has been declared by President Donald J. Trump as a national public health emergency. This declaration of emergency comes after years of abuse. The epidemic has, in a sense, evolved from previous drug epidemics of the past, which we're going to talk about right now.
All modern opioids can trace their ancestry back to one common drug, opium. Opium is derived from the sap of a flower called the opium poppy, with earliest known cultivation dating back to ancient Mesopotamia, where growers often referred to it as the huljil, or joy plant. The Silk Road trade route most likely introduced opium to Southeast Asia, where, for hundreds of years, it was primarily cultivated in India and China before being introduced into American culture by Chinese immigrants in the 1800s.
Opium became very prevalent in the American West around the time of the California Gold Rush in 1849. The mass exodus of gold-hungry Americans to California, coupled with Chinese immigration, led to the establishment of opium dens, small outposts where opium was able to be bought, traded, and smoked. Like a new song released on the Billboard Hot 100, opium usage soon became very popular in the United States, and it was from opium that morphine was created. Morphine is a powerful painkiller that can be used to treat moderate to severe injuries. According to Medline Plus, it acts directly on the central nervous system and can leave the user in a completely numb, euphoric state, which attributed to its usage during the Civil War in battlefield hospitals.
However, after the Civil War, recreational morphine usage became an epidemic. In the 1870s, German scientists created a safe, non-addictive alternative to morphine, which became known as heroin. Quite on the contrary, heroin led to an even bigger drug addiction in the United States, instigated further by the introduction of cocaine soon after.
During this time, it was believed that using heroin or cocaine would help treat respiratory diseases such as the flu, so they were oftentimes prescribed over-the-counter by medical and pharmaceutical professionals.
By the 1900s, opiate and narcotics usage had been linked to many cases of prostitution and violent crime. Heroin, cocaine, morphine, and other opium derivatives were brought and sold legally. They were even able to be prescribed by medical professionals.
Insane, isn't it? That is until 1914, when Congress passed the first piece of legislation that attempted to control the American drug epidemic, the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act. This legislation sought to provide for the registration of with collectors of internal revenue and to impose a special tax upon all persons who produce, import, manufacture, compound, deal in, dispense, sell, distribute, or give away opium or coca leaves, their salts, derivatives, or preparations, and for other purposes.
The bill had damaging effects that were seen almost immediately. Physicians who were prescribing drugs to addicts on maintenance programs were harshly punished. Thousands of physicians were convicted and fined, or even jailed. The Harrison Act also indirectly led to the establishment of an underground drug market, which in turn led to more instances of drug-related crime.
Additional pieces of congressional legislation, such as the Anti-Heroin Act of 1924 and the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, coupled with the start of Prohibition in 1919, attempted to give the government stronger control over the use of dangerous substances, but nonetheless, drug abuse persisted. On the other hand, though, the anti-drug legislation of the early 1900s caused cocaine usage to go down for several decades until the 1980s.
Opiate and narcotic usage waned briefly during the 1930s up through World War II, but amphetamine usage took off.
Even famous icons were affected by drug abuse. As stated by a Timeline article in 2016, Judy Garland, most famous for her role in the 1939 classic The Wizard of Oz, was drugged up with amphetamine pills by MGM to keep her awake and active on set, and unfortunately she later developed an addiction after her film career was over and died at an early age.
During World War II, pilots used methamphetamine and benzedrine to keep them awake in the air, and came home from battle with an addiction. These coming decades would soon see an increase in amphetamine usage, along with a resurgence of opioid abuse.
Amphetamine usage drastically increased during the 1950s due in part to mass marketing by pharmaceutical companies, claiming that amphetamine pills could treat anxiety, weight loss, and depression. In response, anti-drug propaganda also began circulating during this time with the intention of mitigating escalating abuse. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics in particular created myths and horror stories about drugs. For example, marijuana was blamed for bizarre cases of insanity, murder, and sex crimes. However, some of this propaganda seemed so far-fetched that no one heeded the government's warning about drugs.
The counterculture of the 1960s made drugs fashionable, and youth often experimented with new drugs, such as hallucinogens like LSD. Overseas, U.S. troops fighting in the Vietnam War used heroin and marijuana excessively to deal with the many instances of PTSD brought on by the war. President Lyndon B. Johnson's administration went as far as to classify drug abuse and alcoholism as mental illnesses, and attempted to force rehabilitation upon drug offenders with the Narcotics Addict Rehabilitation Act of 1966. While drug abuse, experimentation, and demand was growing exponentially, it was not until the 1970s that the federal government really took action against the American drug epidemic, and the modern opioid epidemic loomed behind it.
Starting in June 1971, President Richard M. Nixon launched a political campaign entitled The War on Drugs, aimed at combating drug use and incriminating confirmed drug users and dealers. He declared famously in his speech, "America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new, all-out offensive."
As part of this initiative, he created the Special Action Office for Drug Abuse Prevention and the Drug Enforcement Agency in 1973. The War on Drugs campaign led to an increase of longer and harsher prison sentences for drug offenders and was believed by many people to specifically go after blacks and hippies, who were often stereotypically associated with cocaine and heroin, respectively. Ultimately, most historians agree that Nixon's war on drugs was a losing battle, and that it fueled drug abuse even further.
The inauguration of Ronald Reagan in 1981 continued and even expanded on Nixon's drug policies. The 80s was characterized by a cocaine epidemic and even higher rates of incarceration, from 50,000 in 1980 to 400,000 by 1997. Minimum prison sentences began at 5 years. Drug-related incarcerations, many resulting from the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, were seen as racially driven because they allocated longer prison sentences for offenses involving the same amount of crack cocaine, which was used more often by black Americans, as powder cocaine, which was used more often by whites.
Critics also pointed to data showing that people of color were targeted and arrested on suspicion of drug use at higher rates than whites, leading to disproportionate incarceration rates among communities of color. The media covered this extensively.
President Reagan also spent an estimated $1.4 billion on eradication and interdiction programs during his first term alone. He also decreased funding for drug education, prevention, and rehabilitation programs. Education, however, was something that First Lady Nancy Reagan championed. She famously began the Just Say No campaign, which sought to educate children on the dangers of drug abuse and discourage illegal recreational use. Her efforts helped to increase awareness of substance abuse, but there is no evidence of a correlation between Just Say No and a decline of drug usage in the 80s.
The 1980s closed out with continuing abuse of cocaine, decreased funding on drug rehabilitation, and skyrocketing incarceration rates that rose as much as 500% by the 2010s. The modern opioid epidemic was just beginning.
The modern opioid epidemic is said to have begun in the 1990s. During this decade, public support for the war on drugs began waning. The cocaine epidemic also died out, ushering in the period of opioid abuse. Opioids were made available via medical prescription or importation by means of foreign drug cartels.
Poison control separates the opioid epidemic of the last 20 years into three distinct waves, the first of which began in 1991, and the third of which began in 2013, and is still ongoing.
According to Lindsay Liu, Diana Pai, and Paola Soto of the U.S. Poison Control, the first wave was characterized by the prescription of opioid and opioid combination medications for the treatment of pain. The increase in opioid prescriptions was influenced by reassurances given to prescribers by pharmaceutical companies and medical societies claiming that the risk of addiction to prescription opioids was very low. During this time, pharmaceutical companies also began to promote the use of opioids in patients with non-cancer-related pain, even though there was a lack of data regarding the risks and benefits in these patients. By 1999, 86% of patients using opioids were using them for non-cancer pain. The second wave of the opioid epidemic started around 2010 with a rapid increase in deaths from heroin abuse. The use of heroin, which was cheap and widely available, increased in both men and women, the majority of age brackets, and all socioeconomic groups. Deaths due to heroin-related overdose increased by 286% alone from 2002 to 2013. And approximately 80% of heroin users admitted to misusing prescription opioids before turning to heroin. The third wave of the epidemic began in 2013 as an increase in deaths related to synthetic opioids like fentanyl. The sharpest rise in drug-related deaths occurred in 2016 with over 20,000 deaths from fentanyl and related drugs. The increase in fentanyl deaths has been linked The increase in fentanyl deaths has been linked to illicitly manufactured fentanyl used to replace or adulterate other drugs of abuse.
An estimated 26 million to 36 million people worldwide abuse opiates. According to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, in the United States, an estimated 2.1 million people abuse prescription opiate pain relievers such as oxycodone, and about 467,000 Americans are addicted to heroin. In recent years, the rates of opiate addiction and opiate-related deaths have risen. In just 1 year, from 2014 to 2015, the death rate from synthetic opioids increased by 72%, and heroin death rates increased by almost 21%, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention explained in 2018 that roughly 68% of the over 70,200 drug overdose deaths in the United States in 2017 were due to opioids.
The opioid epidemic has also seen influences from foreign drug cartels, which have been able to import opioids by land, sea, and air. One of the more notable cartels was the Sinaloa, which was led by notorious drug lord Joaquin Guzman Loria, infamously nicknamed El Chapo. El Chapo built an immensely profitable drug trafficking empire throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, smuggling in roughly 200 tons of cocaine to the United States, as well as heroin, meth, and marijuana. He was also connected to the murders of between 2,000 and 3,000 people, and appeared on Forbes magazine's list of billionaires from 2009 to 2012. He has escaped from high-security Mexican prisons on many occasions, and is currently standing trial at a federal court in New York.
El Chapo, what a man. The existence of foreign drug cartels and the supposed idea that illegal drugs are entering the United States through low security points at the southern border is a main reason why President Donald Trump and many of his political allies are arguing for the construction of a wall at the border. While this is no doubt true in some aspects, the El Chapo trial has also proved that heroin, cocaine, and other deadly drugs are entering the country through other means.
Sonia Mohe and Maria Santana of CNN reported in January 2019 that most drugs are smuggled into the United States on board fishing boats, trains, tractor trailers, and ordinary cars that come into the country at legal ports of entry. According to former cartel members who've testified at El Chapo's trial. Illegal drugs have also, on many occasions, been flown into the United States on private planes.
The current Trump administration has adamantly pointed fingers at legal immigration as a reason that the opioid epidemic is becoming increasingly dangerous. Illicit drugs have no doubt been flowing across the southern border and have fueled instances of violent crime, and overall have increased the dependency on opioids since more people are being exposed to them. Since he first campaigned for the presidency, Trump has argued that building a border wall will not only reduce illegal immigration, but will also combat the raging opioid epidemic.
In January 2019 radio interview, U.S. Representative Nita Lowey of New York claimed that most opioids come to the United States through points of entry.
The following are quotes from her interview as well as a fact-checking analysis by Jill Ramos from PolitiFact. Lowey stated in her interview, "Building the wall is critical to impeding and denying the flow of illicit drugs into our country." Ramos's follow-up analysis proved that the data showed that far more drugs are detected at points of entry than between points of entry. Excuse me. The Office of Field Operations, working at points of entry, seized 4,813 pounds of heroin during the first 11 months of fiscal year 2018 through August 31st, 2018. During the same period, U.S. Border Patrol, which works between legal points of entry, seized 532 pounds of heroin. CBP states, CBP statistics from 2012 through 2017 show similar disparities between heroin seized at points of entry and heroin seized between points of entry. The data also show that fentanyl, another opioid, was seized at points of entry at a higher rate than at between points of entry.
Now that we've talked about the long history of opioids and drug abuse in the United States, as well as its current effects and influences, it's time to offer a solution to the deadly epidemic that has claimed the lives of so many people.
I like to think of the opioid epidemic through a simple analogy, a river with two tributaries. The river represents the opioid epidemic, and the two tributaries symbolize the ways through which people can access opioids, illegally and through prescription. The two tributaries flow into the larger river, keeping it well-fed and supplied. To decrease the river's water supply would be cut off one or both of the tributaries. Banning opioid production and prescription helps combat the epidemic on one front, thus blocking one tributary. But to cut off the river's supply entirely, border security also must be increased. Therefore, the solution would be to cease the production and distribution of opioids to fight the epidemic at home, and border security must be heightened in order to curtail the influence of foreign drugs.
Elaborating on that analogy, doctors are under more pressure than ever before to either make profit for their respective hospitals and/or clinics, and those in private practice face the pressure of escalating insurance rates and malpractice suits. We live in a society that focuses on treatment. There is no margin in curing diseases or sicknesses. Modern medicine and big pharma focus on treatment. If they can make and produce medication that has the potential to become highly addictive, then there is no downside to them. They will do whatever is legally possible to make money, and they don't care what happens to the consumers being affected.
Big pharma heavily courts medical professionals and I am sorry guys, today's not my day. Big pharma heavily courts medical professionals and incentivizes them to hawk their products, and pharmaceutical lobby has become one of the most powerful lobbyist forces in Congress. Chris McGreal of The Guardian explained in 2017, pharmaceutical companies spend far more than any other industry to influence politicians. Drug makers have poured close to $2.5 billion into lobbying and funding members of Congress over the past decade. Lobbyists have also ignored how the number of opioid-related deaths have quadrupled from 1999 to 2015, instead blaming the deaths on addiction alone rather than the addiction stemming from prescription. Because they have been able to bribe politicians into striking down legislation that would place restrictions on drug companies, pharmaceutical lobbyists have contributed to the opioid epidemic in that they have allowed for it to drag on unregulated. This must change.
As part of his second State of the Union address on February 5th, 2019, President Trump addressed the opioid epidemic as part of his plans on addressing border security with the construction of a wall. He said, "Walls work, and walls save lives. To many opponents of Trump's border wall, it is a moral and ethical issue. But on the other side of things, having a wall and stronger security will reduce the amount of illegal substances that enter our country through areas of our border that are unprotected."
There is evidence to show this. Congresswoman Debbie Lesko of Arizona offered her insight as to why better border security is needed and why having a wall would work. "There are illicit drugs," she stated, "there are illicit drugs flowing through our borders, human trafficking and dangerous cartels exploiting vulnerable women and children. I asked the Border Patrol agents I met on my visit if they thought the wall would help. They told me yes, the wall will help in their efforts to combat illegal immigration and other activity along the border. That's because walls work. It is a protective infrastructure that deters unlawful border crossings and other illegal activity where our natural barriers, such as rivers, mountains, and other impassable terrain, do not exist." In 2000, the Department of Homeland Security built a wall in the Tucson, Arizona sector. Over 15 years, border apprehensions from CBP dropped by 90%. In 2005, DHS built a wall in Yuma, Arizona. There, border apprehensions dropped 95% over 9 years, according to CBP data. These are just a couple of places where we've built a wall, and the wall has worked.
The president has asked for $5.7 billion in funding for a wall. If our politicians truly care about ending the opioid epidemic, then they need to reach a compromise regarding the wall.
Alex and I think that the solution to winning the fight against opioids in America is clear. The government must regulate or even eliminate pharmaceutical lobby and place a ban on most opioid production and distribution. Additionally, increasing border security will help to apprehend the illegal drug trade and curtail the flow of illicit substances into our country.
This two-part solution requires bipartisan agreement and cooperation on both fronts. Only then will this terrible epidemic end.
That's about all the time that we have for today's episode. Thank you for listening, and a huge shout out to my co-host, Alex Hess. Next week, we'll be talking about the effects of pushing for the full legalization of marijuana.
Thanks again for listening. Don't do drugs, and see you next time on You Don't Need Heroin to Be a Hero.